How do you sum up this weekend, this series?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to describe, you know. Tough, frustrating, but we got to turn the page, you know. We got to keep going. We got to find a way to start getting the victory here. That wasn't a good showing there. They pretty much outplayed us.
I know you guys talk about, like, the belief in the team, the belief that the team is better than what they're showing, which is how hard does it get to keep saying it just when the results aren't there on the field?
Yeah, we got to go out and do it, you know. We want to keep saying it. But the bottom line is we got to go out and do it, you know. We want to keep saying we got the talent, we got the players, but until we start playing better and getting the job done, we continue to believe in the guys, you know. And we will, you know. It's tough. I know it's tough right now. It's very frustrating. We're all very frustrated, you know. But we got to keep going, you know. We got to keep going. Nobody said it was going to be easy.
I know you guys.
I feel like they're slipping away from you here a little bit.
No, I mean, we can go on a run. I mean, we still got time, but, it just takes putting it together, playing some good baseball, but I don't think the division is slipping away. We're still within shot, and, we've been known, this team specifically, to go on runs, so we can easily, rattle off a winning streak. Especially with the people that we've got here, but it's going to take obviously turning it around.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Monday, August the 11th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG, and don't forget the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to an off-day edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. And let's be honest here, and I'll start with this. And maybe there are some in the audience that don't know this movie, but back in the early 90s, I think it was, Bill Murray did a movie called Groundhog Day. Andy McDowell was in it. There are a few others. And if you saw the movie, you know where I'm going. But basically, Bill Murray's character, he's a news anchor, gets stuck in replaying the same day over and over and over again to the point he almost drives himself insane. Now, the point of the movie was there was a lesson in that. And at the end, Bill Murray had to learn his lesson in order to actually, move on to the next day. But I don't know if that's what Mets fans are experiencing right now, or the Mets, or Carlos Mendoza, or Francisco Lindor, anybody on the roster. I don't know if they're in Groundhog Day, but unfortunately, coming to you today, I've probably done this edition of the show two or three times, particularly in the last 2 months. And we all knew as we went into the weekend series against Milwaukee after the awful showing against Cleveland, after the rough homestand, the near no-hitter, and I had said, I think it was Thursday when I came to you with our late-week emergency podcast, that this thing might get better, might get worse before it gets better. And unfortunately, not only did it get worse, but it was an agonizing weekend of baseball. Every game the Mets could have won, they lost in different ways. They beat themselves. How frustrating it is to see journeyman players like Isaac Collins beat you. Joey Ortiz, a significantly below league average hitter, beat you. Your big bullpen additions not get the job done. It's very frustrating. And, I think what I'm at the point, and this is really where this is a tough show, but I really thought about how the message would come across. And what the message is. Because I'm not going to sit here and defend anything. I'm not. But I'm also not going to take the position that I see a lot of fans taking, at least on social media. Again, going into the firing of the hitting coaches or the manager or second-guessing the deadline. I mean, even second guessing bringing in Ryan Helsley in the eighth inning. Why didn't you go to Diaz for a six out save? You just gave up three major prospects to have two closers, so Diaz doesn't have to do that. And I mean, again, you're getting beat here over and over again. And look, give Milwaukee credit. They're playing way above their heads. You don't want to, you don't believe me, you want to get angry about it. There's metrics. There's a graph that shows the amount of lucky wins they've had. Now, there's always luck as a product of design, but when you think about sustainability, when you think about kind of players you want on your roster, Joey Ortiz, Isaac Collins, these are not the way you drew it up. But that's the beauty of the sport. Let's call it like it is. And their pitching has certainly put them in a position where they can come back. I mean, they had a bad day yesterday, and certainly the Mets showed more life offensively this weekend, with the exception of the game against Brandon Woodruff. They had him in trouble early, but you know they couldn't capitalize anything further. You know, so you don't want to take anything away from Milwaukee, but you're at a point where the anger needs to be put aside, and I'll tell you why. You could be disappointed. You can be frustrated, but I think ultimately what we all expected was a breakthrough after last year. And up until about June 12th, we thought there was a breakthrough. Now, let's be fair. You can't judge the team on just the last 2 months alone, and you can't throw the last 2 months away, and you can't throw the first 2 months away, but you can't overstate it either. I mean, every team falls to their level. They could be hot as a pistol for the first 90 days of the season and cold as anything the final 90 days. Look at just a year ago, the Philadelphia Phillies, the team the Mets beat in the postseason, a team that was shocked that they lost to the Mets in the postseason. They were a 500 club pretty much the last 2 months of the year plus. They were a great club the first 3 months. They were having some of the, you know, the best starts of any Phillies team has had. They won the amount of games they were meant to win. And I think all of us, especially after the hot start, and we talked about this, we expected this Mets team to take the next step in the David Stern, Steve Cohen journey into a 9,500 win team, at least for the next few years, as they try to leverage the, you know, primes, late primes of Alonso and Nimmo and Lindor, and then obviously the prime, you know, of Juan Soto. And you thought that, you know, whatever move Stern's made, because last year he hit on so many of them, whether it be the pitchers, Harrison Bader, you know, that was going to continue with who they brought in, guys like Montas and so on and so forth. And then, of course, the young kids. Well, how can they not have a couple of these kids start to evolve? Look at what Mark Vientos did last year. Look what he did in the postseason. Alvarez coming back and hitting the next stride. Everybody loved Ronnie Mauricio even before Stearns came aboard. And then you have the darling of, you know, Mets fans at times, Brett Beatty, because he's this, you know, coach's son, former top, you know, number one prospect. So all these things put an expectation forth that, quite honestly, probably was misguided. Because the reality is such that the way Stearns won in 2024, hitting a few lottery tickets with the, you know, value bin, is something that doesn't always happen. And the kids might not be as good as we think. And let's be honest, and I've said this, this is not a second guess. The one big gripe I have about Stearns and the way he builds teams is how this whole bullpen is fungible and how he messes around with it pretty much until, you know, 90 games in. That bothers me because that's where games in 2025 are majority won and lost. Maybe for the Mets more because their starters can barely go four innings. You know, he did that as well. And we haven't even gotten, and I'll get to that in the second part of the show, and there might be some uncomfortable truths about some of the core offensive players that we don't want to face. Maybe. I'm not saying I have absolute truth on that, but maybe. And I'm not going to get into that now. So when you add all of that together, you pretty much have an in-the-muck team, 85 to 90 wins. And we were starting to have this conversation before the 7-game winning streak against Anaheim. And if you remember, the same people, I believe, a lot of the same people, I believe, that are yelling and screaming about Mendoza and firing the hitting coaches, how embarrassing the Mets are, and this is unacceptable, and angry at this team, were angry that I insinuated a few weeks ago, not that long ago, that maybe this is not a playoff team. That maybe this is a team in the muck. And that's exactly what they are now. Now, I don't believe, even after the awful weekend in Milwaukee, the fact that they've lost in two stretches, 21 out of 23. I mean, think about that. What are they, 8 games over .500? They're 2-21 over 23 games, which means they're 28 over outside of that. I mean, that's the epitome of streaky. And you heard Brandon Nimmo. For some reason, this team believes they could just go on a run, and I think that's dangerous because what they did last year was historically significant and not the blueprint of how you make the postseason. Let's be honest. Let's be honest on that. So when you look at this team and you put it all together, pretty much they're very similar to last year. Different in the sense because last year at this time, the starting pitching was starting to ascend and make its move and pretty much be the reason why they made the postseason. They got just enough out of their bullpen pieces. Phil Maton was huge for them. Diaz found his stride late. And offensively, and here's really where I think the big difference is, the kids this year, the Beatties, the Mauricios, have not been able to make up some of the production lost from the veterans like Bader and Winker, veterans that did a really good job last year. And Mark Vientos has taken a significant step back and put a hole in the lineup that they really haven't been able to recoup. So when you look at everything that's balanced, you know, now you have this super bullpen that's failed you a couple of days, and quite honestly, you haven't really been able to use it to its highest level. And the guy out of the bullpen that gives you the most confidence is the guy that throws the slowest and has the funkiest delivery. That's Tyler Rogers. And I always, I just like the guy. I mean, that's the one guy that I'd sign to an extension today if I could. When you look at it all together, this team is a mixture of good and flawed, which puts them in that third wild card 85-90 win scenario. Now, I got some emails, and more than one. It's not just one. And I see people talking on social media how angry they are that the Mets are still in this spot. And I understand that. And I even see people talking about how, well, maybe Stearns wasn't all that great. Matt Arnold might have been the wind beneath his wings there. He's been there since Stearns took over in 2015. Matt Arnold, talented executive, learned in the Tampa organization under Friedman, came to Milwaukee and was there with Stearns for a decade. That's a lot of knowledge that puts you in a great spot to look really good when you get the big job. Let's also remember, there's a lot of things going on with Milwaukee that from an analytics standpoint, Arnold's looking pretty good. Let's see how it sustains out. Let's see what happens when Andrew Vaughn is your big hitter in the postseason, when Isaac Collins is asked to do what he did in the postseason against big pitchers in big moments when the lights are very, very bright. Not knocking it, just saying, I mean, that's maybe a little bit unfair. I think we all continue to forget that since Sandy Alderson, and I'm going to say this for the billionth time, and you've heard it probably a billion times before, that when Sandy Alderson got sick in 2018, this team went into a cycle of turnover that is very difficult to overcome. Quite honestly, they've had more turnover than some lousy organizations like the Pittsburgh Pirates. And the kind of turnover they've had with the number of player development heads in charge, GMs, members of the front office. Remember, each regime brought their own people in. And as Stearns came in, there was a blend of Alderson and Zach Scott and Brody Van Wagenen's people, and even Alderson layovers. I mean, with all that together, that's a tremendous amount of turnover, a tremendous amount of disjointedness. And then you have the whole fact that Cohen comes in the middle of a pandemic. And hey, by the way, I got to wash away the stench of the Wilpon negativity. And throughout all this, they've been able to provide you an entertaining product, a product that puts you in the mix well into the fall and football season, and then some. And that's not the goal. The goal is not to just do that. The goal is not to be an in-the-muck team. But for anybody here on year two of Stearns to be upset that that's where they're at, I'm sorry. I think you're not giving the guy enough leash here. Stearns has a 5-year deal. The earliest I think you could really start to see his impact and his evaluation is at this time next year. Just after the game yesterday, some of the big prospects that now are more on Stearns, not all of them were Stearns' prospects, but some are. The Nolan McClains, Carson Benj was promoted to AAA. Brandon Sproat, let's see what happens there. Jet Williams. These guys are all now starting to make their way to AAA. The next, young, potentially baby Mets that we talk about might be Benj and Jet Williams. It might be Sproat, McClain, and Tong. I mean, Jonah Tong now and Sproat and McClain a hair away from being key members or at least getting an opportunity to be key members of the rotation. This time next year, we could have a better feel he's going to have 3 amateur drafts under his belt. He's had his own people in the organization over 2 years. He's worked out and gone through a couple of trade deadlines and moved through some of his, the holdovers that he had. Now, do I agree with everything Stearns does? Well, the first move he made, I didn't agree with. I want him to have a veteran manager like Buck Showalter stick around. Turns out, he brought in Carlos Mendoza. And I know that a lot of people think they know what Carlos Mendoza is and isn't and how he acts. Quite honestly, I think Carlos Mendoza is balanced. I think he holds players accountable. I don't think you see it. I think he's very honest with the media about his thoughts. He doesn't sugarcoat things. He's very direct and to the point. And, anybody, and I see this float around anytime the Mets have a losing streak, this yearning for a Terry Collins fake outrage rant. Terry Collins was not a tough guy. Terry Collins was a guy that had good veterans manage his clubhouse. When they were successful, the veterans that had an impact and managed that clubhouse were Michael Kadire, Curtis Granderson, and David Wright. It was not Terry Collins. And the minute those guys went out the door and their skill set declined, the Mets went into hell in a handbag. One of the reasons they got rid of Terry Collins because he was lousy with young players. Not to mention the fact that he was not an impactful manager as you got into the modern era. He lacked basic understanding of the bullpen. He was a guy that, if you had a veteran club and you needed someone to kind of placate the media and do all the things you need to do to take the peripheral distractions out, he was the guy. Was good at, knowing who to feed stories to, was good at giving a show for the fans of the media, like what you see floating around. And let's face it, the guy had 16 good weeks. Maybe there was some flawed rosters, but some of the issues that the Mets had was Terry Collins' poor management, his inability to manage a bullpen. He blew a World Series because of that. So I'm not getting into that today, but let's not do revisionist history here. The Mets have a manager that I think is a solid manager. They have a solid president of baseball operations and a guy that I think is going to lead them to better days and continue to put them in the mix every year. And maybe there are things we don't know. Like I saw a comment made, and I'm sorry, I can't remember whether it was tweeted or it was emailed to me. I'm sorry about that. Well, if Mendoza was a guy that yelled and screamed and if Stearns did this and et cetera, it would be reported. I don't think so. The whole journalism dynamic has changed. I love the beat writers. I have a couple of them come on my show. But this ain't the days of, when Harper and Klapisch came up and Keith Hernandez is smoking a cigarette, giving them inside information at his locker. That don't happen anymore. Stuff stays in the clubhouse. Players can hide very well. Teams could firewall their players. And a lot of that has to do with you can't really control the message. Social media has made guys like me become part of the mix. It has every Mets community on social media or end user on social media or radio host on social media able to stir the pot at a moment's notice. So I don't think you get all the information to make an assumption or an educated opinion about the management that is or isn't going on. All I know is this, is that the president of baseball operations gets paid $10 million a year, that's highly respected around the league, that if he was fired tomorrow, would be scooped up in 37 seconds walking out of that door. Trust me on that. Thinks that his team is prepared, his coaching staff is doing what it needs to do to get the guys prepared and hold them accountable. And maybe some of us who are from the old school are yearning for Bill Parcells and Pat Riley, whatever. You could name an old school coach, Earl Weaver, so on and so forth. Davey Johnson. But that's not what the game is anymore. And you can get those messages across without the taskmaster mindset. And again, we don't know what Mendoza's doing behind closed doors. And the other thing is, you want to hold players accountable. You want to start sitting Nimmo. You want to start sitting Lindor. You want to start punishing guys for not hitting. You sit Lindor. What's your option? Mauricio at short? You sit Nimmo. What's your option? Tell me. Cedric Mullins and Tyrone Taylor in the outfield? You put all your eggs in these guys' baskets. There is no, you know, and I see all this. People say, well, they got to do something to change it. Once you get to this third phase of the season, the, you know, go get it done phase, either you go get it done or you don't. And the real thing is, we have to manage expectations as a fan base, me as a commentator. We overestimated the cycle of where this team is. They're not at the breakthrough stage yet. Maybe they'll have it. The season's not over yet. They're not at the breakthrough. They had their innocent climb last year. They had a nice first season on the Stearns. They are still the same 85 to 90 win in the muck team. And you want to know what the real scary part, and it should scare the hell out of you, is that if Benj and Tong and Williams and Sproat and McLean are no good, like the four guys I'm not so sure any good that are on the roster now, now you're staring down the barrel of a big problem. Because they're going to need those kids to come in and be impactful. I'm not saying they have to be a Hall of Famer, but they can't be going through 3 years of growing pains like Brett Beatty. They can't be in 2 years getting sent down like Francisco Alvarez. This team can't afford it. And that's what should concern you, because you're putting a lot on these kids. Now, I hear nothing but great things about Benj. You see nothing but positives on Tong, and Sproat's coming along, and McLean has always been an interesting character from day one. There are also pitchers that could get hurt. I don't know if they're the next Harvey DeGrom and Syndergaard. Who the hell knows? But all I know is Mets just put these guys at Triple-A. And look, the only other thing, and they're not all going to get called up, but the only thing you can really do now, between now and the end of the year, if you really believe, and maybe it's August 11th, 2 weeks from now, right before September call-ups, these guys are dominating Triple-A, there might be some really wild things that could come into September where, you know, maybe they start pulling these guys in to piggyback or be in the bullpen, or maybe Benj comes in and all of a sudden he pulls a Greg Jeffries 1988 and hits his way into the postseason lineup. It was actually around this time in 1988 where the Mets, who had been struggling for almost 3 months, that they brought Jeffries up and he created a spark. Maybe it was a coincidence. And the Mets rolled the rest of the year and they won the division going away after it looked like a scrappy young Pirates team was going to nip them. So there is some precedent for these young kids being brought up, but the Mets can't bring them up as a Hail Mary. They have to be sure they're ready. And you cannot stunt their development or ask too much of them because you want action, because you're mad that the Mets are not what we thought they were. And to be truthful, to be honest, and I'm as guilty as the next person about this, there was probably signs, and some of you, I'll give you credit, I got those emails over and over and over again early when they were winning. Hey, Mike, there's a problem here. The bullpen, the utilization of the bullpen isn't sustainable. Look at some of the peripherals. Look, I was concerned about the peripherals of some of the bullpen guys like Garrett and Brazenbaum. You guys know that. I spoke about that. I looked at guys like Kodai Senga and said, he's a little bit over-indexed. He's pitching a lot better than what his peripherals suggest. I didn't like the fact that they were only going five innings, but I said, hey, look, that first 60 games through Memorial Day, even into early June, let things transpire and get figured out. Now you're not at that point anymore, and they haven't been figured out. So now you got a problem. You got 1 out of 5 days where you don't know what you're going to get. You got Montas with an opener now. You don't know what kind of outing you're going to get. It's a magic eight ball. Clay Holmes will give you a good outing. You just don't know how long he could go. The only pitcher in the rotation that you have faith that'll get into the maybe the definitely the sixth inning, maybe the seventh inning is David Peterson. And you know, you thought maybe you had an ace, a burgeoning ace in Kodai Senga, but the outing, I'm sorry, you know, the outing he had on Friday is just not acceptable. There is nothing ace-like about Kodai Senga. And the fact that he's got a bad shoulder, that who knows what that ticking time bomb is. We all knew that was part of the deal when he got signed, and that he's as, you know, durable as a pane of glass. You know, that's a problem. So, you know, right now, the only thing I could say is this. Put the anger away of where you want them to be and accept where they are. Because I still think, oh, they are a playoff team as of this morning. I still think that they aren't going to fall behind the Reds. The Cardinals are not contending. The Giants are not contending. You know, the Marlins are a nice story. They'll find a way in the end not to win. They don't have enough. But again, there's another example. A team that was no man's land, last place, now is a little, you know, around the 500 mark, and they've had this incredible streak with the best team in baseball. They're not the best team in baseball. That's what they had to become in order to get to where they should be. And I think that's the biggest part. And before we take a break, because I do have a major concern, and it's Nimmo and Lindor, and I'll get to that. For about a calendar year, from June to June, the Mets were the best team in baseball numerically. Nobody was better. You were sitting on the team that was the Dodgers, was the Yankees, was the Red Sox, whatever comparison you want to make. And it felt good. And at times I remember seeing him saying, well, I know deep down that they played that way and they were hot, but there's a lot of parts of this team that are not the best team in baseball. But last year they had to be the best team in baseball to get to 89 wins. This year they started off with some of that magic carpet ride, but they had to level off because they're an 89-win team, maybe. Maybe less. Doesn't matter where you get them. If you're an 85 to 90-win team, you're going to be an 85 to 90-win team. You could play 650 ball for a stretch. You could play 350 ball for a stretch. You're going to get your 85 to 90 wins. So, you know, that's where it is. Manage expectations. Understand the game of baseball. The statistical levels that everybody hits. Brewers right now playing a lot higher than I believe their statistical level. That doesn't mean Matt Arnold is a better GM than David Stearns. That doesn't mean they're a better organization than the Mets today. You know, we'll see where they land. We'll see. And you know what? Sometimes these streaks last for a calendar year. Mets lasted until October. Logically, the Mets shouldn't have been a team that was playing the Dodgers, even after they made the postseason. A week before the postseason started, you wouldn't have put that on your bingo card. You wouldn't have put money, a lot of money down on Vegas on that. All the Mets got to do is get into the tournament, and I believe they will still get into the tournament. But it's got to kind of stop now, the bleeding. It's got to start on Tuesday. And it'll be a very interesting crowd at Citi Field, a very positive environment, one of the best starts in Mets history at Citi Field before the stubbing of their toe last homestand. Be interesting to see how the fans react to a team that needs them now more than ever. Let me take a quick break. When we return, second part of the show, Francisco Lindor and Brandon Nimmo, slumping or declining? Yes, I said the word declining. I have some concerns, and I'll talk about that right after this.
2-2. Ortiz, a chopper up the middle. Going to be a tough play. It's off the glove of Lindor. One is in Vaughn. Perkins right behind him. Two runs are in on a top spinner from Joey Ortiz. And the Brewers are in front.
And you can tell Lindor is looking at the runner, taking his eye off this baseball before he's able to glove it, and two runs score for the Brewers. A rare mistake from Francisco Lindor at shortstop.
Goes as an E6.
All right, we're back. So the one thing I left out of the opening here was the real glaring situation that this team has. And everybody talks about how streaky the top four hitters have been and how disappointing they've been. I'll take Alonso and Soto out of it. Yes, Soto has not been as good as you want year one of this contract, but he's still pretty damn good. I mean, he's a top 15 hitter in the sport. And truthfully, anybody who criticizes Alonso, he's as good as he's been in the best year of his career, which I would put 2022 as the best year of his career. He's driving in runs. He's hitting home runs. He's outstanding at first base and saving a number of errors with his scoops. I mean, every night he's making an athletic play at first base on the scoops. Maybe his range isn't the greatest all the time, and I know he had the yips for a while on throws to first. I think he's over that. I am not concerned about Pete Alonso. He is who he is. The biggest concern you have about Pete Alonso going forward is if that bat slows down, he's going to become a once-in-a-while home run hitter strikeout machine. And we're not there yet. He's been slumping collectively all four, particularly since the 4th of July have been slumping. There's no doubt about that. But when you look at it, Soto in his prime, first-year adjustments, not uncommon. We've talked about other hitters who needed time to adjust. Carlos Beltran is a perfect example. He didn't even have as good a year as Soto his first year in New York. So there's that. So I'm going to put those two guys aside. That's not the conversation for today because I'm really not worried about them. I think they're going to be who they're going to be, and I think Soto's going to be even better. And if Soto has a big September, that would be huge for this team. If Soto makes up for some of the less-than-Soto performance we've seen for stretches this year and he makes it up in September, what a perfect time. You know who did that not too long ago? Well, it's actually long ago. It's 27 years ago. Mike Piazza. Look at his September 98 statistics. That's when the city fell in love with Piazza, and he probably decided he wanted to stay between the energy of that run and the fact that that might have been the best month I've seen of Piazza in his Mets career, and that was his first year here. That's my opinion. I'm sure statistically we can make arguments on that, but he was everything you needed out of a Hall of Fame hitter that September of 98, his first season in New York. So we'll see. Now, as far as Nimmo Lindor, my concerns are completely separate. Nimmo is a concern, and I've said this over and over again, because he's got a couple of major injuries that we continue to glaze over. First, if you remember, for a while now, about 6 years now, he's had a herniated disc in his neck. That's a serious injury. A serious injury. That's a compromising injury. And he played late last year in the postseason with plantar fasciitis, which could come and go. Both of those injuries are injuries that, even when they're managed and maybe not flaring up at a level where it's visible on the field, is going to compromise him in a way that he can go down the tubes pretty quick. Now, Nimmo is a different player than the Nimmo that we really grew to love and re-signed for a long-term contract after the 2022 season. He's gone from this elite run creator that gets on base and generates runs in any way, shape, or form to more of a strikeout machine, power hitter, a guy that is more a bottom-of-the-order hitter, a six guy, than he is a top-of-the-order run creator. Now, I don't know if that's because of a change in his his abilities to, go about his craft. You know, maybe the analytics department said, hey, you could hit more home runs, you'd be more valuable. Your walks are not having the same impact as you driving in runs. We need you to be more of a RBI guy, maybe. I'd like the Brandon Nimmo that Brandon Nimmo was in 2022. I'm not saying I mind a Brandon Nimmo hits more home runs. And look, Brandon Nimmo also this year had a really good stretch of baseball for a couple of months where, basically in June and July, he had an OPS, significantly above 800. I mean, in June, when they were, even when they were struggling in June, he 879 OPS, he hit 298. But Brandon Nimmo has hit a .129 in August and has looked awful. And he's swinging through fastballs down the middle, which means either he's in a deep, deep, deep slump. And we saw this before. We saw it last year for a long while, a similar type of performance in the second half. It's ironic that as we get into the dog days of August, Nimmo, similarly to last year, is declining, which makes you wonder, does the wear and tear of the season, is it taking its toll? And Nimmo is a key offensive player, a player that you just can't sit on the bench and assume you're going to make up that production. Now, the production he's giving you now, there's nothing to make up. Anybody could do that. But that's a real serious conversation. Why is he having, again, a swoon in the second half? Why is he looking as bad as he's ever looked? And knowing that he has these injuries, and we don't know what other injuries he has that he's not telling us, he's intimated time and time again that he's got health management situations he has to work through. What's the situation? And I will tell you that those injuries that he has could potentially derail his career, where he becomes either a part-time player or not a very good baseball player. And I think starting next year, or even maybe at some point, assuming that maybe a Carson Benge, and I think less likely a Jet Williams, who knows, pushes their way into the conversation on the roster. And I don't think that that's, I don't think it's a high, I don't think it's a more than 50% chance that happens, but I think it's a higher chance than maybe just 3 weeks ago or a month ago. You know, I think that Nimmo's going to have to start taking a couple of days off. Whether that means it's DH or completely shutting it down for a day, my guess with those injuries, you just want to not play baseball for the day. We'll see. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is Lindor. Lindor is a little bit harder to put your finger on. Now, let's not forget he had a back issue last year, and he did not deny that it may be something that he has to manage right now. Remember, and it was actually another, and again, I apologize. I was in a fury of tweets going back and forth with fans yesterday. I know some people don't like when I get into my Twitter rages, but I know one fan made a point. You remember how Edgardo Alfonso hurt his back and he wasn't the same player. I don't know if Lindor has that kind of back injury and that severity. I believe Fonzie had a disc issue. That becomes problematic and it winds up derailing you. But if he has back issues, it's going to be a problem. And it's going to be something that at a demanding position like shortstop may require him to start thinking about taking some more time off. That's not a position that you can just hide on a field. Now, he had the toe, which by now you would think would have healed. There's not much you could do for a toe. But certainly if he's in pain or it didn't heal right, or there's more, maybe there's something more that needed to be done that we're not privy to, that he's not talking about, that could be compromising him. Again, the old adage is, if you're out there in the field and you're not on the IL, then there's no excuses. Any ball player will tell you that, including Lindor. I'm sure he will tell you that. But the thing is, the fact of the matter is this. Lindor is striking out more than ever, walking less than ever, hitting the ball softer than ever. He doesn't look like the Lindor that we felt after his initial foray into New York in 2021 that we've grown to accustomed to seeing. He actually looks worse than the 2021 version. The 2021 version got off to a bad start, just like a lot of guys who get big contracts here get off to a bad start adjusting to a new situation. And then he was pretty good as the season went on. He had some health issues with an oblique, which derailed him. But outside of that, he was pretty good. And he was Lindor that we come to know and love. So this is a new version of Lindor. Now, there is precedent. You know, Nimmo is pretty obvious. Nimmo's north of 30 and has a couple of serious injuries. Even if Lindor's injuries are more manageable than Lindor's, not everybody plays at a high level late in their career like a Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter, from an athletic standpoint, even though he declined on certain parts of his game, he was able to stay on the field till very late into his 30s. I think when he retired, he might have always been close to 40, but I'll check that out. I can't remember right now. Derek Jeter he was 40 years old when he retired. And he had a major injury that kept him out a significant amount of time in between 38 and 40, but I digress. Barry Larkin played at a very high level into his late 30s. Mets acquired him. He didn't want to play here because they knew that he'd be a really good fit for that 2000 squad. Maybe things are different if Barry Larkin accepts the trade to the Mets in 2000. But there's plenty of precedent of big-time shortstops that hit the age of 31, 32, where Lindor is. Now, right now, Lindor is 30. He's in his age 31 season. Lindor turns 32 in November. So he's going to play the entire season at age 31. Now, by the age of 32, even though Alan Trammell, Hall of Famer, was still a pretty good player. He was no longer the all-star MVP gold glove type. Actually, his age 32 season was his last really 1990s, really Alan Trammell Hall of Fame season. Okay, he wasn't the same player after that. Cal Ripken became a below-league average player after the age of 31. Ernie Banks, at a similar age to Lindor, had to move off a shortstop. He was a first baseman. Still hit the ball well, but he was nowhere near the same MVP elite Ernie Banks that Cubs fans grew up watching in the 50s. So, at some point, I know that modern medicine sometimes isn't the same. It's certainly not the same as when Trammell and Ripken and Banks and maybe Larkin and Jeter, especially Jeter, are more comparable in terms of how you can play into your, you know, late 30s, because they're in a more modern medicine era, particularly Jeter. And the Mets have Lindor signed, and they're going to be paying him $34 million a year until his age 37 season. So this could be equally a problem. I mean, you could have between Lindor and Nimmo. I mean, Lindor's getting $34 million a year. And I think Nimmo's getting 25, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, Nimmo is getting about, no, 20. He's getting 20 points. That's not terrible. But both until the age of 37 are going to clog up $54 million of payroll. And we might be 2 years away from potentially there being roster restrictions on, you know, similar to the NBA. I really believe, if you believe, I think next year is the last year you're going to see a carte blanche financial system where Steve Cohen will, without penalty of some sorts, be able to use the greenbacks to pave over some bad money, like he's done with Verlander and Scherzer. And to a certain degree, Starling Marte is not, you know, he's having a nice season as a component player, but he's not a $20 million a year player anymore. Let's put it that way. So this goes back to my point that I think the real scary part about all this, it's not the fact that the Mets are still this in-the-muck team that has to stave off the Reds and may have to even win three games in Cincinnati in September to make the postseason. When it's all said and done, that might be what the difference is. No, it's not that. It's that you have four core hitters. One is a free agent at the end of the year that you have a big decision to make because he's going to get paid by somebody. Somebody's going to pay him because they see the power and they see the defense. And they're going to say, now they're convinced. You know, he kind of washed away those concerns. And he was going to get paid by Toronto anyway. Now, I know we're heading into a labor talk, so maybe that'll change the market. But he's a free agent, so there's no guarantee he'll be coming back. And I know everybody says Ryan Clifford, I didn't mention him earlier, getting called up to AAA. You don't know what Ryan Clifford's going to be. Not every power hitter that comes up becomes a star right away. You know, you've heard about Ike Davis, you know, guys like that. They don't become stars right away. Don't assume that he's just going to slide in and become Pete Alonso. Those are big shoes to fill. Soto's here. He's here at least for the next, you know, 5 years. And I have no doubt he'll be Soto. And if he's not, then that's a problem. But we can't do our analysis based on that. And then, of course, you have these other two guys, Nimmo and Lindor, who are clearly, at least Lindor, I think, I mean, at least Nimmo for sure, is a concern. Where he may fall pointing more towards the Marte world. I mean, Lindor, we'll see. And if Lindor is in the beginning stages of a decline, and we didn't even talk. We were talking about offense. His decline on defense is most concerning. Now, I think some of his decline on defense is not health. I think it's rushing. I mean, the two plays that he made, the one on the throw where he missed Beatty's throw, which is a bad throw, and then the play on Saturday night, which I'm not even sure he would have been able to get anybody out of, but he certainly would have saved a run, for sure. It's him rushing. He's trying to throw the ball before he has it. I mean, it's simple as that. But there's been a lot of clumsy elementary errors that a shortstop of his caliber, a gold glover, an MVP, a guy that many believe is the team captain, even if it's just in theory, not in practice, shouldn't be making. He's on pace to make more errors than he ever has in his career in a single season. I don't know if that part's a decline, but it could be. You know, that could be the back. That could be health. There could be something going on. Lindor's not going to tell you that. He may throw it out there at the end of the year when it's all said and done. It may come out through the, you know, back channels. But I will tell you, you know, yesterday the big news might not be the Mets losing to Milwaukee on the field and the losing streak. The big news might be Clifford, Tong, Sproat, Williams, Benj being promoted to AAA and a hair away from the big leagues. Because you might need those guys. And you need those guys to be a hell of a lot better than Alvarez, Mauricio, Beatty, etc. and Vientos. Because you cannot, even for the next 3 years, expect the core offensive players, at least two of them, definitely one, maybe two, to be the only options, the hubs, and everybody else is floundering. You need them to be, at the very least, you know, what Michael Conforto brought to this club when he came up in 2015. The Mets haven't had that. The Mets don't have what they had in 2015 with a Michael Conforto coming up through the system to add to the offense. And at times he became a core offensive player before he fell off a cliff for whatever reason. They need that. They need Benj to be that. They need, you know, and the best case scenario is Benj and Jet Williams are core offensive players. And if Nimmo becomes a component Marte type, then you live with it because he's been replaced. And maybe you don't have to rely on Lindor's offensive much if he is declining as he gets into his mid-30s because, you know, you got Jet Williams, you got Benj there and what have you. This is huge. This is huge. Now, I know Stearns just had an amateur draft, but you're talking about the next 2 to 3 year window with some of the players you have on the roster. And by the way, that includes Soto because Soto could opt out after year five. Now, he's leaving a lot of money on the table, but look, if he's at age 30, 31, if he's still elite, someone's going to give him a contract and they'll find a way to make up whatever he loses into his late 30s. Again, it's probably going to be a different financial system, so who the hell knows? But, you know, there's where it's at. And don't expect, I think this winter is going to be very different for the Mets, and I'm not going to get deep into that, but it's going to be very different for the Mets because I think they have to be real careful at how much more big money long-term contracts they add to this payroll because you just don't know what the lay of the land is going to be post-2026. And you don't want to become a, for comparison, an overcapped NBA team stuck with contracts, something that the Knicks have been a few times in their history in the last two decades, because at that point, you're just riding out the players, and it could get ugly because the players can't do more than what they're doing. You can't make any changes. You're completely locked in. Now, that's a scenario where you rebuild. Cohen's really not at that point. You got a lot of momentum here with this brand. They need to make the push. Look, if they don't win a championship, no one's going to kill them. That's very disappointing. Best case scenario, you got a 20% chance of bringing home a title in any given year. And if you look at the fan graphs or even the baseball reference odds, even the best teams only have like a 6 or 7% chance of winning it all. It's hard. More than likely, you're going home in October, November, unhappy, even if you have a great season. That's what the probabilistic outcomes are. So, you know, that's the elephant in the room. Here's what I will say. I don't know what the next, you know, 6 weeks or so to October bring, but I think it'll bring a lot of dialogue and conversation. Hopefully, it'll be a lot more positive and less tedious watching the club and being part of the social media community than it's been over the last week. And I think we should really keep an eye on what happened late yesterday with the promotions to AAA of the young kids, because that might be a decision that Stearns has to make to shake this thing up. And it has financial implications as it starts their free agent clock. And it certainly has developmental ramifications. And it also has 40-man roster ramifications. Let's remember that. So you're putting a lot of stock in kids right now that are dominating lower levels. Let's see. Let's see what they do at AAA. So that's all I have for you on this off-day edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Of course, you know what? Keep going to the Substack. I'll be there doing what I do. I'm going to try to do another spaces with you guys over on X. Just keep, you know, I'll promote it over on the newsletter, even if you're, everybody will get that update, even if you're a free subscriber. And just continue to stay tuned as we, you know, follow this storybook type of situation, not a storybook season, but the storybook. Every season is a storybook. How the story goes, it could be a horror story. It could be, you know, it's like the yellow brick road going to Oz here. You don't know what you're going to get throughout each and every day. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets, no G, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. And I want to thank the good folks at the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast on Sunday. Till then, take care, everybody.